This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
Today, we're bringing you the story of a Jane Doe, found brutally murdered in the desert. She goes unidentified for decades, but when her identity is finally revealed, a shocking new mystery unfolds. This is the story of Marina Ramos, murdered in the Mojave.
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
Our story begins on the morning of December 12, 1989, when four women from Ohio leave Las Vegas for a trip to the Grand Canyon. They're traveling south on Highway 93 in Arizona, about an hour and 20 minutes outside of Vegas, when one of them sees something interesting on the map. It's a ghost town off of White Hills Road, and it looks like it's not too far off the highway. So, being somewhat adventurous, they decide to check it out. The turnoff takes them onto what was at the time an unpaved road, which would be nearly impossible to find if you weren't following a map, or if you were unfamiliar with the area. So they head off through the desert with nothing to see for miles but sand, scrub brush, and an occasional yucca tree. They're a few miles off of Highway 93 when they spot a dead animal lying along an intersecting trail. They comment about it but continue on down the road. After what seems like several miles with no sign of anything, they give up on the ghost town and turn around. As they retrace their route back to the highway, they once again come upon that dead animal and decide to take a closer look. They stop the car and get out. And as they approach, they realize it's not an animal. It's the body of a woman. The location's remote. They're in the middle of nowhere. And we're not sure if they didn't have a cell phone or maybe they just didn't have cell service, but they drove to the nearest phone, which was in Kingman, Arizona, about 36 miles away. The call goes to the Mojave County Sheriff's Office. Now, I want to give you some perspective on the size and scope of the area. The Sheriff's Office covers 13,000 square miles of incorporated and unincorporated Mojave County. That's a massive area to patrol. The closest deputy responds. Today, this case is in the hands of Mojave County Sheriff's Investigator Lori Miller. She takes us back to the scene and what those tourists stumbled upon in 1989.
She was nude. She was sprawled out basically to the side of the main dirt road, if you would call it a main dirt road. But there was no effort to hide her. She had just been dumped there. And she was in a pool of her own blood. And it had appeared that she had been dragged from one area of the road to the other, like pulled off to the side.
The location of the body is on a desolate and seldom used trail called Old Temple Bar Road, just off White Hills Road. It's so isolated, it doesn't even appear on most maps. White Hills Road intersects with Highway 93, and today there's a truck stop and service station there. The body was found about 3 miles east of that point.
It's pretty wide open, desolate, scrub, desert.
We asked Investigator Miller how the victim was killed. And I want to warn you, the details are graphic.
The original detectives on scene surmised that they had first tried to kill her by running her head over with their car tire. Her head was placed behind the tire and then she was backed over, which in the soft sand resulted in just injuries to her face, but not in her death. I will say that the right side of her face was basically torn away because that was obviously the one side down that when she moved in the soft sand, it just resulted in tearing it. So once they discovered that, it appeared to those detectives that they cut her throat several times and she bled out there at the scene.
The cuts were described by the detective as slashes to the victim's throat with a knife. Investigator Miller told us there was no murder weapon left behind, but a couple pieces of evidence are found near the body, including a piece of black yarn and a blue bra strap that may or may not have belonged to the victim.
Because of its remote location, who knows? And it's kind of a windy area. They assumed it belonged to her because it was in close proximity.
The crime scene told detectives that the victim was killed right where she was found.
She bled right out there, and that's how they determined that she had not been killed somewhere else and dumped, because there was indication that sometime prior to her death that she might have been beaten in certain areas around her hips and stomach area.
Two of the original detectives on the case were nationally recognized trackers.
If you look at the course of these old investigations, tracking was one of the main things that they did in providing suspect information. And that's how they came up with the identification of the two suspects that they did, in as far as the height and weight differential. And
there's a traditional Native American tracking technique called cutting for sign. It's used to interpret physical evidence like footprints and tire tracks. Here's what the trackers found.
From the footprints, he's described suspect one as approximate height of 5'10" to 6'2", stride length of 29 inches, approximate shoe size of 10.5", and shoe brand of Nike. Suspect two was approximate height of 5'4" to 5'8", approximate stride of 28 inches, and approximate shoe size 7, shoe brand unknown.
Since the description of suspect number two sounds like a smaller frame person, I asked Investigator Miller if original investigators thought that it could have been a woman.
You know, they did not. I'm kind of reading into it that suspect two could be a woman.
The tire impressions left by the suspect vehicle were also interpreted with precision.
They described the vehicle as a mid-sized sedan with a tire width of 6.5 inches, a tire type of a three-groove radial tire, a wheelbase length of 99 inches, width inside of 49.5 inches and outside of 62.5 inches.
We asked Miller about the location of the crime scene.
That 93 runs from Las Vegas down to Phoenix, that it could have been someone just using that area as opportunity, coming from Vegas and heading down the road towards Phoenix.
Is the location significant?
You know, that's always been a question, because you almost have to have some kind of knowledge that that road exists. And, you know, that she was found like at noon. And so she hadn't been there that long. So in essence, around that time of year in December, it stays dark here pretty long. So it's like you're traveling down that in that area in the dark. I don't know how you could just spot that road without having some kind of knowledge that it exists.
It was determined that the victim had only been there for about 8 hours when she was found. There's no identification on or near the body, so she becomes Jane Doe. In most murder investigations, detectives will do a door-to-door canvas of neighbors and nearby businesses. But out here in the sprawling desert, there was nothing. No neighbors to interview. No businesses. No surveillance cameras. Nothing. We asked Investigator Miller about the autopsy findings.
Okay, they put her at 5'3", double pierced ears, no amputations or deformities, regular weight, no obvious tattoos or scars, and was between like 25 and 35.
The autopsy showed that the victim recently had a baby, but the rape kit did not show any signs of a sexual assault. She had no rings, no jewelry. There was nothing on the body. The detective told us that the bruising noted on the victim's hips could have been part of an assault that led to her death. And she said the pathologist did find some trace evidence from the victim's skin near her stomach. It had apparently glowed under a forensic light source and was secured. But DNA science in 1989 isn't what it is today. Laboratories would have required a larger, good quality specimen. Modern forensics can now amplify the smallest specimens, giving detectives much better chances at getting a DNA profile. This was a tough investigation for a number of reasons, but one of the first things detectives had to do in 1989 was to try to figure out who their victim was. They sent her fingerprints to Las Vegas Metro PD and the FBI with negative results. And they submit the case to the FBI's VICAP, the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, where police agencies submit violent crimes, reporting on known suspect or victim information and modus operandi to connect them with other solved and unsolved crimes. But again, there were no matches. The victim's description was entered into NCIC, resulting in several missing persons of similar description who were investigated and eliminated. They also sent out teletype messages to other police agencies who may have reported a missing person. And they even ran a story in an old detective magazine of the day, but there was never a connection made with their Jane Doe. With no leads as to their victim's identity, the case goes cold. But in 1991, Mojave detectives are contacted by an FBI agent who is investigating a serial killer by the name of Joseph Nissenson, who at the time was in custody in Tacoma, Washington. Nissenson's M.O. had some consistencies with the murder of Mojave Jane Doe. Detectives run a records check and find that both Nissenson and his known associate, Henry Staub III, had been arrested in Mojave County in 1987 for narcotics violations. And these two men match the physical description of the suspects determined by the footprints left at the scene.
They believed that my victim's homicide had a similar M.O., which to a degree she did, but they were mainly targeting young teenage females, white females, and Marina's Hispanic, and she's over the age of 25 at the time. So she did, but she did not. I believe that that's just why they reached out.
Nissenson was convicted of the murders of three teen girls in California between 1981 and 1989, and the murder of a 46-year-old woman in Washington State in 1991. One news report said that Nissenson preyed upon vulnerable runaway girls and subjected them to unimaginable pain and torture. He's been sentenced to death for his crimes. Staub, the man who was with him for that narcotics arrest in Mojave County in 87, does not appear to be mentioned in any of Nissenson's murders. Nissenson and Staub's fingerprints were compared to prints obtained from items found at the scene, but the examination was inconclusive. There were not enough points for comparison to either confirm or eliminate the two as suspects.
You know, it was good effort. Unfortunately, that didn't pan out either.
With no further leads to pursue, the case again goes cold. That is, until 2020, when investigator Lori Miller gets the case. She's a retired police officer of 25 years from Los Angeles PD and now works as a cold case investigator for the Mojave County Sheriff's Office.
Vast majority of my background is working narcotics investigations, but I can tell you once I got into doing this and talking to these families, a vast majority of our work here has been in identifying John and Jane Doe's through DNA profiling and genetic genealogy.
Miller jumps right in and starts working the case, combing through the file and all of the reports, detectives' notes, autopsy photographs, and evidence, like pieces of a puzzle. Then in February 2020, she resubmits fingerprints of her Jane Doe to the FBI.
It was putting the puzzle pieces together when I first was contacted by the FBI guy that she had been identified via her arrest in Bakersfield. I reached out to records, both Kern County and Bakersfield PD.
The fingerprint hit was Miller's first big lead. So she calls the Bakersfield police and Kern County sheriffs in California.
It was a very tenacious woman in the records department in Bakersfield that took the time to help me out and see what, for lack of a better word, old school hard copy records that they had on her. And in doing so, she provided me with the names of two women. The one last name was a common Hispanic surname, so that was like a fruitless search. But the second one led me on a possible follow-up and found that this woman was possibly located now in Tennessee.
The name that pops up in the paperwork is Maria Ortiz. That information leads to the Tennessee address of a possible cousin named Esther. Tennessee police physically go to the address, but no one's home, so they leave a business card with contact information for Investigator Miller in Arizona.
And later on that evening, that's when Esther reached out to me. I asked her, "Do you know this person?" And she said, "No, I don't know that name." But I have a cousin named Marina Ramos who has been missing since 1989, and it could be her.
For the first time since 1989, police might finally have a name for their Jane Doe. Esther said that her cousin, Marina Ramos, was last seen in 1989. She also said that Marina had used fictitious names in the past. One of those names was Maria Ortiz, the name associated with the shoplifting arrest and fingerprint search. But then, Esther asked a question that hit Investigator Miller like a ton of bricks.
Okay, and then she said, and what about her little girls? And I was like, okay, what about these little girls? And that's when she proceeded to tell me that actually Jasmine, I believe, was born while Marina was in jail for the shoplifting. And Elizabeth had been born the year prior to that.
Investigator Miller began working this cold case looking for the killer of a Jane Doe. And after DNA testing, her identity is verified. She is Marina Ramos. But now, in addition to having a murder case, detectives now have two missing children. Marina's relatives back in California told Investigator Miller about Marina's often impulsive lifestyle. The family assumed that she and the babies had settled down somewhere long ago. But for more than 30 years, there had been no contact. And now they know why. But still, her family wants to know, where are Elizabeth and Jasmine, who were just 11 months and 2 months old when they were last seen?
Two missing babies with family that's asking where are they, would like to know where they are, and can you please find them for us?
Now, at this point in the story, we need to go back and fill in some history. Marina Ramos was the oldest of five children. Her parents were from Puerto Rico, and the kids were raised in Lamont, California, about 20 minutes from Bakersfield. But they also spent time in Puerto Rico. Marina's little sister, Margarita, has some fond memories.
We used to have a lot of fun, you know. Always hang out together. We used to go do things together. She was fun to be around.
As Marina got older, she became more rebellious. Her mom wanted her to live by her rules, but Marina wanted to live life on her own terms. When Marina was about 15, her parents and siblings moved back to Puerto Rico for a time, but she stayed in California with her aunt. Her mom eventually sent for her, but when Marina got to Puerto Rico, her mom found out that she'd been keeping a secret. She was pregnant. She gave birth to a little girl she named Maria. After the birth, Marina told her mom that she wanted to go back to California. Here's Marina's sister, Margarita.
And then when she ended up having her baby in Puerto Rico, and she was still doing her things, you know, that wasn't right. My mom would try to correct her. And that's when she started, you know, wanting to go out and do things, and she wanted to leave the house. And my mom told her, well, if you want to leave and do whatever you want, you're 18. And that's when my mom told her, no, you're not taking the child. You can do whatever you want, but the child stays. You know, and that's how my mom ended up keeping Maria.
So Marina came back to Lamont, and eventually her family did too. She loved her family, but they were still trying to tell her what to do. At the age of 27, Marina gave birth to her second daughter, Elizabeth, in June of 1988. At that time, she was in somewhat of a tumultuous relationship with a man named Fernando. The family doesn't know his last name or really anything about him, except they say he used to hit Marina. The relationship was rocky. They'd break up, but then she'd always go back to him. We also learned from Margarita that Marina was secretly seeing another man named William. By this time, Marina had drifted away from most of her family. Here's Margarita.
I think it was at the end of 89. I could be wrong. I don't know, October, November. I was working at this convenience store, and I was at the cash register, and then I seen her when the door opened. I looked up, and it was her, and I was kind of surprised. I was, oh my God, what you doing here, you know? She goes, oh, we're just driving around, my friend, and I just wanted to stop and see how you were doing. And we talked for a little bit, you know, probably like 10, 15 minutes. And that's when I kind of, you know, gave her some advice to be careful who you get involved with. Sometimes people don't have good intentions, you know, and to take care of herself and the baby, you know. That's when she left. Gave a hug, and that was it. I didn't see her no more after that.
So Marina kept some distance with most of her family. But Marina was still close with her younger cousin, Esther. So in 1989, Esther was watching one-year-old Elizabeth when a now pregnant Marina was arrested and jailed for shoplifting. Marina gives birth to her third daughter, Jasmine, while she's still incarcerated. Esther, who was only 15 or 16 at the time, picks up the baby from jail and takes her home. Now, she's caring for both of Marina's baby daughters.
And it was her when Marina got out of jail and showed up with Fernando to come pick up the girls, because Esther actually had the girls at the house when they were on their way, allegedly, to Ontario to this better life that she was supposed to have had that never did take place.
Investigator Miller mentioned Fernando, but this is not the same man Marina had been previously dating. This is a new man with the same name. So we're going to call him Fernando number 2. Marina met him near her home when she was with her daughters, Investigator Miller.
Marina would take them to the park, the little girls to the park, and she met him in the park nearby. According to Esther, she thought he was shady, and she didn't believe his real name was Fernando.
According to Margarita, Fernando number 2 also went by another name, which was Monico. But she also said he didn't like it when people called him that.
Yes, drove a fancy black SUV, wore nice clothes, probably somebody that Marina would have been attracted to.
So Fernando number 2 promised Marina and her girls a better life in Ontario, California.
And that's when she said she was going to pick up the girls. And that's when she showed up with Monico. And that's when Monico said, no, well, she'll be fine. I'll take care of the girls and her. They'll be okay. We're going to Ontario. Esther goes, says, I even got on my knees. I begged her, don't take the girls, don't take the girls. And then Elizabeth didn't want to go with her mom, with my sister, you know, with Marina. She begged her and begged her, but she said, they're my girls and I'm going to take them. She goes, okay, well, let me just get them the clothes and your birth certificates of the girls. She says, but when I went in and came back out, she was gone. She took off with the girls.
The last time Esther saw Marina and the girls, they were getting into a black SUV with Fernando number 2 in Lamont. And the last words Marina ever spoke to Esther were, I'll call you. But that never happened. Police would like to know exactly who Fernando number 2 or Monico is. He may or may not be connected to Marina's body in the desert. The wheelbase and tire description from the crime scene don't seem to match up with a large SUV in 1989, but maybe he used a different car. Or could Fernando number 1 have something to do with it?
That's what we're thinking. That's what me and Esther were talking about. You think that she called Fernando, Fernando picked her up. No matter where she went, she will always call Fernando and go back to Fernando with number 1. But Fernando used to hit her number 1. You know, he always used to beat her up. And I was asking, when I told Esther, but why keep going back to him? She could, because he had a place for her to live. That's why. She would do her things, but she will always go back to Fernando number 1.
And maybe the suspect or suspects are someone else altogether. Unfortunately, there are no photographs of Marina with Fernando number 2, and very few pictures of Marina at all. Police only have one photo of daughter Elizabeth, and no pictures of Jasmine. There's a composite sketch of Fernando number 2 made from Esther's recollection and prepared by Tennessee authorities where Esther lived at the time. You can see that sketch in our show notes. Police tell us that Marina had gotten Social Security numbers for both of her girls so they could receive benefits. But when police checked with the Social Security Administration, there was never any activity under those numbers. But because they were so young, it's possible that they took on new identities. Unfortunately, there's nothing that Investigator Miller can point to say that there's any proof of life for the girls. But she argues, and strongly, there's nothing to say that they're dead.
I believe they're still alive. I just think somebody just took the opportunity at that time to obtain new Social Security numbers for them, and that they're hopefully living and thriving as somebody else under different Social Security numbers.
Investigator Miller did say that there was no evidence at the crime scene to indicate the presence of the two girls. Could they be with Fernando number 1 or Fernando number 2? We still don't know who either of them are. Earlier, we mentioned that at autopsy, the pathologist found some trace evidence from the victim's skin near her stomach. Miller had that evidence tested for DNA.
I had one little piece of plastic that the doctor who did the autopsy said that it shined just above her cervix in her stomach area. It shined for the possibility of semen. I actually looked at the plastic bag and I couldn't see anything in it, but I got the okay to send that back in. And from the scrapings off of her stomach area, they were able to, in fact, obtain and develop a profile, which they just this last December put into CODIS. So I do have a CODIS profile as we speak.
CODIS is the National Combined DNA Identification System, a database of DNA samples from convicted persons used by law enforcement to compare against evidence from crime scenes and to identify missing and unidentified persons. So far, no CODIS hits. We asked Investigator Miller if she had a theory on Marina's murder.
This is part of my problem is to actual location. I think her activities, what she was known to do, I think she left her daughters with somebody. She hooked up with these people, and her activities got a little out of hand and led to her demise. The only thing is I can't locate a specific location, you know, where that could have happened, nor can I find, was there any evidence to resubmit and analyze that would lead me to the location where she could have first met these people. Once again, it was between Las Vegas and Phoenix on a stretch of highway.
Investigator Miller said she occasionally receives calls from people learning about the case, thinking that they might be Jasmine or Elizabeth, who would both be in their 30s today. Miller said the easiest way to find out if you might be related is to upload your own DNA profile into an open-source genealogy DNA database where people can find relatives based on their DNA. Marina's eldest daughter, Maria, has her profile on those platforms. So if you think you're related, that would be the first step.
The best thing for people to do is to take a commercial DNA kit and upload their kit number and their kit to GEDmatch and FamilyTree DNA. If they firmly believe that they are one of the children, if they want to contact me with their kit number, I can compare them. But in essence, if they upload their own genetic information, it will match halfway decently to Maria's kit. And I also work with a genetic genealogist that I can have her take a look too. So if people could assist me that way, that would be the most beneficial to this investigation, because those two young women have family that want to meet up with them. They've communicated to me that they have, you know, a loving family that would just like to meet them. And that's what my aim is at this point.
For now, Investigator Miller will continue working any leads that come in on this case. And she hopes for a CODIS hit to the DNA sample they believe to be semen that was recovered during Marina's autopsy. She's also asking for help from the public.
Eyewitnesses are probably few and far between, but somebody out there knows what happened to these two little girls. There's just too many things that happened leading up to Marina's death. There had to have been some kind of activity that led to her winding up on that road. It's been a few years, but somebody still has to be alive that knows what happened and where the girls went and would come forward. It's been so many years now that it's time to dig down deep in their hearts and say, this is the right thing to do. And let me tell you what happened that day and where those two little girls wound up.
The grave where Marina Ramos was buried had a simple gravestone in the county section of the cemetery. It simply said, Jane Doe, age unknown, found 1989. When Marina was finally identified in 2022, her family considered bringing her home to California.
They had entertained the thought of disinterring her and taking her back to Bakersfield area, but she's been here for that long, so long that they just put a very nice headstone in and replaced the Jane Doe.
And this impassioned detective truly wants to be able to call Marina's family and tell them something about Elizabeth and Jasmine.
You know, young women deserve to know about who she was, good and the bad, and she has a family that wants to meet them, have a relationship with them, and, you know, everybody is deserving of that, and that's what my focus is on doing, is trying to bring some closure to them. If I can't find out who killed her, at least I can bring her girls back to her family. Although I have to say, Esther, who was my source, who would, you know, help me with all this, she passed away last September of breast cancer. So she tried to hang on, but she wanted to see these two girls found. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to do that for her.
Investigator Miller continues to work the case, and even though she couldn't get an answer for Esther before she died, she knows there's still a loving family that wants to find Marina's girls.
It would mean a lot, especially to my mom. To my mom, you know, because I was her firstborn child, you know, Marina. Says I wish I could find the girls, you know, they could find them so I can meet them before God decides to take me out of this earth. So all we got to do is pray that they're out there somewhere, you know. But it would mean a lot. A lot to us, a lot to let them know that they have family members besides the people that raised them from their mom's side.
As we spoke with Investigator Miller for this episode, she epitomized the passion and the drive that we've seen in so many other cold case detectives. The work they do is not for them, it's for the victims and their families. And Miller's quick to thank all of those who helped her in her mission. From the police and clerical staff in Kern County, Bakersfield, and Tennessee, to the family members, especially Marina's cousin Esther and daughter Maria, and to Margarita. And she's grateful for the assistance she's received from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
They have been very helpful, and I thank them because they've gone out of their way to assist me. I think it's because of the little girls. It's just something that they deserve to be known and to know their family.
If you have any information about the murder of Marina Ramos, or about her missing daughters, Elizabeth and Jasmine Ramos, or about Fernando, also known as Monico, call Mojave County Sheriff's Detectives at 928-753-0753. Or the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children hotline at 1-800-THE-LOST.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com. APB Cold Case is an original Spawn Group production.